You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Jen Zaman, and I will be your host this evening, as Judy Ansel will be back next week. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local 41 and Pipefitters Local 533. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. That's a lot. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. The Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keeps business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. And we thank our underwriters so much for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, Republicans in Jefferson City are gunning for unions. Now that right to work has passed, they're going after the standard of living of construction workers and the rights to representation of public employees. Our show tonight is called the Jeff City Firing Squad. In the news, is the strike dead? Labor Notes says no one's keeping the statistics. And will Seattle Uber and Lyft drivers be able to make the gig economy work for its workers? Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. And now for the news. This is the news from our side, March 16, 2017. This is from PAI News Service. Maybe now, Columbia University, after waging a three-year campaign against its teaching assistants and research assistants who voted to unionize with the auto workers, will sit down and bargain with them. That's because the university was left on March 7th without much of a legal leg to stand on after National Labor Relations Board hearing officer Rachel Mead Zweighaft tossed out all of Columbia's objections to the vote results last December. Zweighaft reported that UAW won 602-623 with 640 challenge ballots to represent the TAs and RAs at the prestigious private university. The new TA-RA unit, which calls itself the Graduate Workers at Columbia UAW, has 4,256 eligible workers, NLRB records show. There weren't enough challenge ballots to affect the outcomes, Zweighaft noted. The Columbia election is important as a dispute over it led the NLRB to reverse a prior Bush-era ruling and declare TAs and RAs as employees who can organize and unionize under federal labor law. The Bush NLRB stated that the primary relationship at private universities, such as Columbia, was as students, not as employees. That made them ineligible. The latest NLRB union opened the way for union organizing drives at other private universities nationwide, primarily by the auto workers and the teachers. Coincidentally, the same day that Zweighaft announced the Columbia decision, the UAW filed for a union recognition election at Boston College, a private college. That unit would cover 1,200 TAs and RAs.
Politico reports that the Senate voted along party lines Tuesday to repeal an Obama-era regulation restricting the scope of drug testing that states could require for recipients of unemployment benefits. Excuse me. The measure overturning a Labor Department rule which limited the industries for which states could mandate drug testing as a prerequisite for receiving unemployment benefits passed 51-48. President Donald Trump is expected to sign into law making the drug testing rule the eighth Obama administration regulation that the Republican Congress has successfully killed this year through the previously little used Congressional Review Act. That two-decade-old law allows lawmakers to scrap recently finalized executive branch regulations through a resolution of disapproval, which can be passed with simple majorities in the House and Senate. The move was opposed by civil rights groups and labor unions, including the American Civil Liberties Union and the AFL-CIO.
Labor Notes wants your strike story. In a blog on their webpage, they ask, are strikes dead? Year after year, official statistics tell us that strikes are all but disappearing from the United States. But is this the whole story? The Bureau of Labor Statistics only reports strikes of 1,000 or more workers. There are just 15 of those last year. Federal Mediation and Conciliatory Services reports more, but only those directly connected to contract expirations and new contract negotiations. They report that 91 strikes ended in 2016, with another 12 still in progress. The National Mediation Board covers airline and rail strikes, but didn't report any for the past few years. Can that really be it? Most likely not. No government agency keeps track of all of the Fight for 15 fast food and Walmart strikes of the last few years, nor did any official body tell us how many workers struck on February 16th, Day Without Immigrants, or March 8th, Women's Strike Day. Perhaps most crucial in getting the whole picture are the unreported unfair labor practices, ULPs. 20,000 ULPs charges were filed every year. Most are settled peacefully, though through the National Labor Relations Board procedures. But we know some involve strikes, particularly because during a ULP strike, employers are not legally cannot legally hire replacements. For example, did you know about ULP strikes by hundreds of security staff and baggage handlers at Chicago's O'Hare Airport last year? Or members of Teamsters Local 284 in Ohio who struck when International Paper unfairly imposed old contract last May? Or the non-union iron workers in Washington State who did the same? None of these were reported by government agencies. So Labor Notes wants to know the whole story and ask readers to help fill in the blanks. To do so, send an email to strikeulp@gmail.com.
In a column in the Seattle Times, John Talton writes Seattle's law allowing for unionization of app-based ride-sharing outfits such as Uber and Lyft is so important. Despite all the hype over the ride-sharing services as a leap of convenience based on apps, their vast profit potential comes from having very few employees. What a grand way to further redistribute money upward to the 1% until we can have self-driving cars and be done with humans entirely. Drivers are independent contractors who lack the many advantages that lifted up the broad middle class in the middle of the 20th century. It carries the sexy name gig economy, but for many it is a bottom-feeding desperation economy. It also eliminates real full-time jobs that offer any security, benefits, and ladders up. While some of these contractors are doing the work by choice, many are not. The Seattle law, which allows drivers from the companies above, plus other rideshare, taxi, and for-hire outfits, the right of collective bargaining, would be a beginning at restoring some balance. As my colleague Jessica Lee reported, the law is attracting more powerful opposition. The National Right to Work Foundation and the Freedom Foundation, The former, with deep ties to the Wright and the Koch brothers, are representing a handful of drivers suing to stop Seattle. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has refiled its challenge, too, and Teamsters Local 117 recently received permission to begin an organizing drive. This will be an important test. It represents much more than an attempt to arrest or hasten the decades-long retreat of organized labor in the private sector. Seattle's case looks at the future. If gigs are the future for more and more Americans, will they fall back to conditions of the robber baron era, becoming a vast multiplier of the inequality and falling share of labor income that's already hurting us? Or will the gig future carry the worker empowerment that especially comes from unions? It's romantic to think that the individual needs no laws, no unions, no balancing institutions to protect him or her in the economy. But that only happens in Ayn Rand's fiction. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Greg Swartz, and Michael Savoy.
My name is Danny Burleson. From 1981 to 1985, I was in the U.S. Navy as an electronic warfare technician. I'm very proud to serve my country. After getting out of the service, I joined the Union Carpenters, had the opportunity to work on many of the public buildings here in Springfield. I even had the chance to work on Kickapoo High School, where I have two sons who have graduated. I have a daughter who's currently attending. So you can bet guys like me are going to make sure that these buildings are well built and safe. After all, these are buildings that our friends and family use every day. In Missouri, there's a law in the books called prevailing wage. It makes sure that skilled construction workers are paid a good wage. But now, a handful of out-of-state CEOs and billionaires are trying to repeal the prevailing wage law in order to increase their profits. That would mean skilled construction workers, including veterans like me, would get paid less, making it harder on me and my family, and taking money out of our communities. I hope you'll get involved and stand up for good wages for people who do this important work. To find out more about this important issue, go to protectmofamilies.com.
That was a video made by Protect Missouri Families, an organization sponsored by the St. Louis, Kansas City Carpenters Regional Council. I'm Judy Ansel. The Regional Council of Carpenters are currently fighting the repeal of Missouri prevailing wage laws, as are most of our unions in the state. With us in the studio is Joe Hudson, who's been a strong advocate for the Carpenters and has been its political director for over a decade. He's one of the most articulate labor spokespeople in both Topeka and Jeff City, and I expect occasionally in Washington, D.C. So if anyone can explain what our prevailing wage law is in Missouri and what's at stake in the fight to save it, I bet Joe can. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thanks, Judy. I appreciate you having us.
And so, you know, Danny Burleson, the guy in the video we just listened to, is a veteran. And you have another ad that features several veterans who are members of the Carpenters Union. Why are you featuring veterans in your ads on the prevailing wage laws?
Well, first of all, one little short correction. The next ad that we're going to see with veterans in it are actually operators.
Not carpenters. They're operating engineers.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
That's right. But that said, one of the reasons why we're having veterans kind of be our spokespeople, so to speak, is the governor is a veteran, and he ran on being a veteran. The first thing you hear out of his mouth before you hear Eric Greitens is that he's a Navy SEAL, and he's very proud of the fact that he's a veteran. And so, you know, that's one reason why we look to veterans for help here. But really, the truth is that veterans are a huge part of the state's construction workforce. 10.48% of veterans are employed in the construction workforce in Missouri. So, you know, they're a huge part of who we are. And we believe that we've got to stand up for them. They stood up for us during times of struggle for our country, and now it's time for us to stand up for them as well.
Okay. And Greitens is one of the chief backers of repealing our prevailing wage laws. So tell us, what are these prevailing wage laws? What do they do?
So first, there's actually kind of two prevailing wage laws. There's a federal prevailing wage law, and we call that Davis-Bacon. And then there's a state prevailing wage law, the Missouri State Prevailing Wage. Mm-hmm. The federal law covers generally federally funded work, federally funded construction work. The state prevailing wage law generally, I'm kind of going to give it a broad brushstroke here, but generally it's any public works in the state. So it could be a school construction project. It could be a state-owned bridge project, something along those lines. But generally speaking, it's state or publicly funded projects.
Okay. And it establishes a minimum wage, essentially, for the people who work on those projects, right?
That's right. It's a skilled workforce minimum wage. And those wages are determined on the state prevailing wage that we're talking about here. Those wages are determined yearly by the state. They do a survey, and every county in the state by trade to see what wages prevail. They literally collect man hours in every county for every trade and decide what the state minimum skilled workforce wage ought to be in that county.
Does it also include benefits and minimum benefits that contractors have to provide for their workers?
It might. And generally, it does. If the typically union rate prevails and those unions have benefits, those are included in the wage that the state determines for each individual county by trade. Now, the interesting piece to that is if skilled union workers are working on those projects, they get those benefits. If the non-union workforce is working on those projects, they'll see the entire paycheck with the benefits included in their actual pay, unless the employer offers some type of benefit that they can offset. Mm-hmm. Then the worker will not see those directly on their check. So, for example, a carpenter, let's just use round numbers, making $50 an hour and has a $10 an hour benefit package. Like I said, we're using round numbers. The carpenter will see $40 an hour on his check and he'll have a $10 an hour benefit package.
Okay.
The carpenter non-union would see the $50 on his check unless the employer had some kind of benefit for them.
Boy, those seem like really high wages. I know the other side says that you know, like you're robbing us blind with this. What do you say to that?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of folks think that construction workers work 2,080 hours a year, which is what the max that you could work on straight time would be.
If you work 40 hours a
week. If you work 40 hours every week, 52 weeks a year, you're going to get.
How much does the average construction worker work?
I don't know average construction worker. Uh-huh. I can tell you the average carpenter across the state works between 1,600 and 1,700 hours a year. The average construction, the average carpenter across the state makes $54,000 a year on their check. Now, there's a benefit package to that, but they're not a burden on society either, so that's an offset.
Right. Okay. So the effect of these prevailing wage laws is that they end up guaranteeing through being able to work on state and federal work jobs, they end up guaranteeing a living wage to construction workers who otherwise would probably be in poverty and collecting food stamps. Is that the idea?
Yeah. I use an example, a carpenter in Joplin. A carpenter in Joplin, their total package is about $40 an hour. Well, if you take that times 2,080 hours a year, you would think that guy's making $80,000 a year. That is not the case. You have to multiply his $25 actual wage and multiply that times $1,600 or $1,700. That is about $37,000 a year that a carpenter in Joplin is actually making. Now, he has health care and a pension to retire on, those type of things. But the Republican supermajority and the governor think that that's too much. They think that $37,000 a year is too much for a carpenter to make in Joplin, and that ought to be reduced. Our argument is, how can you possibly reduce that? The carpenter making $37,000 in Joplin is probably going to own a house, probably going to pay property taxes on that house that go into our public schools that carpenter is building, similar to what you heard Danny Burleson talk about. Now, if we reduce that, let's say we reduce that 85%. You reduce that 85%, now that carpenter in Joplin's making $30,000. He's probably going to live in an apartment. He's probably not going to pay a whole lot of property taxes on anything. And he could possibly be on state child care aid. So now we're moving a fine line of $7,000. We're shifting a carpenter that's making a living, going to work every day, doesn't have a whole lot but making it, to shifting that to possibly being on some type of state aid. The effects of prevailing wage are wide and far at every level of our government, whether it's mostly involves our tax base.
Let's talk about some of those and the arguments, because the people who want to get rid of our prevailing wage laws, and we'll get into what the bills are in a few minutes, but there's a bunch of them. But the people they're arguing that the taxpayers are being robbed blind by these greedy unions who are charging way above market price for construction. So you told me that, in fact, there's a bunch of studies that show that that's just not true, that what the state government or cities are paying for construction is actually not going to change very much if we get rid of prevailing wage. Could you talk about that some?
Yeah, so the opposition, or the folks that want to repeal prevailing wage, generally will argue that if we repeal prevailing wage, we can see a 20% cost reduction in the industry. The facts show 75% of peer-reviewed studies, so these academic studies go out and the peers in the academic industry evaluate those studies. 75% of those studies that are peer-reviewed show that repealing prevailing wage damages the state's economy. And the 20% argument doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The peer-reviewed studies that I'm talking about will show an average of about 23% for labor. The other parts of the construction part are material, fuel, you know, construction contractor overhead, profit, those type of things. But the labor piece itself is 23%. So for the argument to be that they'll see a 20% reduction by repealing prevailing wage means that our workforce is going to have to work almost for free. That just doesn't pan out.
So, okay. So the state's not going to save money in terms of like cost per square foot for construction, right?
No.
And also, my colleague at UMKC, Michael Kelsey, did a study a few years ago about Missouri's prevailing wage laws. He found some really interesting things, too, about the cost to the state in tax revenue.
Yeah. One of the things in that particular study that you're talking about, the loss of income and revenue is somewhere between $225 million to $360 million lost to the state annually.
Is that state and cities or just the state?
You could argue that it's going to be both in the end.
Because, like, the cities will lose earnings tax and property taxes probably and lots of sales taxes.
Some of the contractors that would then come into the state, possibly from wherever, are going to cheat those taxes, you know.
Right.
And pay cash. They could possibly pay, you know, make their workforce 1099. There's not going to be.
That's contract labor.
That's right. And No longer will you have the state overseeing the prevailing wage law. So I use the analogy a lot of times that if there's no police or highway patrol out there, we're all going to speed and go really, really fast. Well, essentially, you take prevailing wage off the table, you have no watchdog out there watching over the workforce and the projects, making sure that the taxpayers' money is used wisely.
And even now, the watchdogs aren't always on the job. You told me about a case you just heard about yesterday involving the city of Belton. You want to tell about it?
I believe it was the city of Butler, actually.
Oh, it was Butler.
I believe so. Apparently, they had some work that, and I won't get into specifics. The case is still in the courts. But apparently, they had a project where the city of Butler decided not to use prevailing wage, not to inform their contractors that they should use the prevailing wage law, which they're required to do, and replace a roof on one of their maintenance facilities, if I'm understanding it right. The contractor came in, hired some folks. One of the guys they hired was a delivery person for a major delivery company in town. Not a skilled roofer. And so they're going to let this guy do some roofing. He ends up falling off the roof and breaking both legs and becoming paralyzed probably for life. Obviously not going to be able to deliver packages anymore.
So he didn't have the proper safety equipment, obviously.
He didn't have the proper safety equipment. He didn't have the proper training.
Any idea how much they were paying him?
I have no idea how much they were paying. I'm sure it wasn't the
prevailing wage.
Prevailing wage for that area. Uh-huh. Now, you know, another argument is now the city of Butler is going to have to end up paying more than they would have if they would have hired a skilled worker
and
a skilled contractor in the beginning.
Right. They're going to be – I would assume they're – if he had no workers' compensation insurance – then the city's going to be liable? Is that correct?
I would assume that's the case, and I'm pretty sure that might be part of the
civil case. So your argument then is that if you repeal the prevailing wages laws altogether, there's going to be even less oversight. There's going to be more entities in the state and cities who are going to hire low-road contractors. What about out-of-state contractors? Are we going to see an inundation of contractors and workers from out of state, do you think?
Well, the statistics show that right now in Missouri, when a construction project is performed, 92% of the work is done by in-state contractors. Now we take our neighbor Kansas, the number is literally 12% less than that. So 20% of the workforce, or I'm sorry, not the workforce, but 20% of the contracts that are let in the state of Kansas are done by out-of-state contractors. So, you know, there is an economic piece for our employers as well, right? When an out-of-state contractor comes in, he's more than likely going to bring his workforce with him, and those tax dollars are going to leave the state.
Mm-hmm. You know, I looked up all the bills. You could do word searches, and it was real easy to have prevailing wage pop up, and it popped up on 14 different bills, 9 in the House and 5 in the Senate. They're really trying to get rid of these laws, but some of them don't do it completely. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so first of all, you're exactly right. I mean, we're just talking about prevailing wage and how many bills there.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of right-to-work bills too, right?
Right.
They passed that already.
Well, they passed that. We're workers' comp. Paycheck deception.
Yeah, right. The second half of the show, we're going to be talking about that.
Oh,
one.
There you go. So there's a ton out there.
Yeah.
So the point is that there is a direct attack on labor. The governor has taken dead aim, as I like to call it, because that's one of his commercials on labor and workers in the state. But some of the bills that you're talking about, full repeal of the law is the one that we're focused on the most because that's the most
damaging. Which bill is that? Do you remember the number?
Senate Bill 20, I believe, is the bill. Some of the other bills would be to repeal prevailing wage for school construction.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real split for rural legislators that want what they would think is some reprieve on prevailing wage.
Okay. We're just about out of time. Quickly, who's against it and what are you asking people to do?
The folks that are against it, it's really a national movement. I'm sure folks that listen to this show have heard of ALEC.
Uh-huh.
ALEC, it's
American Legislative Exchange Council.
There you go. It's one of their main bullets. They are going state by state trying to repeal labor protections and things like that. Prevailing wage is one of them. So that's really, I think, where this generates from. There's an ideological split. The governor is steadfast on repealing this in the State of the State address. It's amazing to me that he says 11 times in his State of the State address, I'm for higher wages and better jobs. Says that 11 times. And the first three policy things that he wants to do is enact right to work, repeal prevailing wage, and repeal project labor agreements. Just exactly the opposite of higher paying, better jobs. It's amazing. He's talking out of both sides of his mouth. Yeah. But the other folks, there are some in the industry that would like to see the repeal of prevailing wage, and a lot of it is in-state and out-of-state big donors.
Okay. Big Republican donors.
Big Republican donors.
Yeah. David Humphreys comes to mind as an in-state
He's
guy, right?
One of the biggest, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And quickly, what should people do?
People should reach out to their state senator, to their state house rep, to the governor's office. A real easy way to find who your state rep is or who your state senator is to just Google Missouri Senate, and it'll probably pop up legislator lookup. You can very easily enter your address, and it'll pop up all the different folks that are your representatives. We're asking folks to write letters. That's probably the most important and the most effective thing that you can do. Write your personal story. If you live in Kansas, talk about how you come to Missouri and work. If you're a veteran, tell that story about being a veteran and enjoying a good living wage in the community that you live in, and how repealing prevailing wage will hurt you and your family.
Okay. All right. So we've been talking to Joe Hudson from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, the St. Louis, Kansas Carpenters Regional Council. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thanks. I appreciate you having us.
And stay tuned. We're going to be talking about another attack on working people coming from our legislature, this one on public employees.
Capitalism is a system, and as a system, it has a momentum, a structure. The president, by himself, cannot change that.
On Friday, March the 24th, college professor, economist, author, and radio personality Dr. Richard Wolff will be the featured guest at a meet-and-greet dinner, followed by a talk entitled Trump's Economic Strategy and What to Do About It. Details of this KKFI fundraiser and ticket information at kkfi.org.
This week, the conclusion of a speech delivered in California by Dr. Vandana Shiva, where she speaks more to solutions, especially solutions based in human rights, allied to rights of nature. Life as Diversity, on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30. On March 16, 2003, American Rachel Corey was killed as she placed her body between Palestinian homes and Israeli-American bulldozers. We remember Rachel on the 14th anniversary of her murder on the Thursday night special at 7 p.m.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and we're back. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. And in this half of the show, we're going to be talking about Missouri public employees. They happen to be some of the worst paid public servants in the country. That fact is clearly related to the very weak labor laws, which make it difficult to organize and favor the state in bargaining. Add to that a conservative legislature, and even though the state constitution gives all workers the right to freedom of association, our unions in the public sector are weak. One of the strongest voices for overworked and underpaid state workers is Bradley Harmon. He's president of CWA Local 6355, which represents workers in the state's Department of Social Services. He's going to tell us about the toxic stew some state Republican legislators are cooking up for his members. Welcome to the show, Bradley.
Hi, Judy. Thanks a lot.
So tell us, I count four bills that are specifically designed to weaken unions in the public sector. They're House Bills 251, Senate Bill 21, House Bill 637, and Senate Bill 210. Is that all?
So far, I think that we're not yet past the deadline for filing new legislation. So we could see more, but yes, there's quite a menu already.
Okay, so let's start with the least bad and go to the worst. Can you explain first a little bit about what paycheck protection or paycheck deception bills are and where they came from?
Sure. So back in the day, you know, the 30s, the 20s, turn of the century, when labor organization was starting up, unions collected dues directly from their members. So you'd have a shop steward who would go around on the floor in the workplace and get dues from all the union members and give them like a pin or something to show them that they'd paid their dues for that week. That's a big pain in the neck. And workers decided a long time ago that they would rather let the boss take care of the collection of dues and distributing it to the union. And so a standard practice for decades in organized workplaces is an agreement that management will deduct the dues that union members decide to pay to the union from the members' paychecks. And give the dues money to the workers' union so that they can operate and have an organization. So that's been in place for a long, long time. There have been a series of repeated efforts in Missouri starting, I'd say the first, maybe the most serious attempt first was in 2013 when the legislature passed a paycheck protection bill that would require union members who work for the public, so people who work for school districts or for the state or for a city or a county, would be required to do an annual authorization for their dues to be deducted from their paycheck. So the legislature passed a version of this in 2013. They passed a version again in 2016. Both times the Senate failed to override Governor Nixon's veto of those bills. The numbers got worse each year. In 2016, the veto override failed in the Senate by only one vote. So there's been a serious attempt to go after the ability of public employees to simply pay their dues as union members. There are the House has passed House Bill 251, which is a substantially similar bill to the bill that Governor Nixon vetoed in 2016. The Senate Committee on General Laws has referred Senate Bill 21 to the Missouri Senate, which is a substantially similar bill to the one that Governor Nixon vetoed in 2013. Both of those require a union member to send in a new authorization to the employer once a year to allow them to continue to be union members. You know, we don't like this at all. It's, you know, state employees that we represent, for example, are typically working, you know, often 60 hours a week in offices that are 50% staffed. They're extremely busy and extremely harried. The state doesn't give them enough resources to do their job. And adding a requirement that they continue to turn in paperwork every year just to remain members of the union is, we interpret, an effort to undermine the ability of public employees to organize and have strong organizations. And those are bad. Those are really bad. They're major restrictions on our rights. But those are honestly the least damaging bills that the leaders of our state legislature are pushing now aimed at public employees.
They don't these bills also cover deductions for voluntary political action contributions from your members?
Yes, they do, which is interesting. That's really some of the stuff that's really pretty unnecessary. I'm certainly not aware in CWA, or for that matter in any other public union that I know of, there's no requirement that a union member contribute to a political action fund as a condition of membership in the union. But this sets restrictions on public employees' ability to do that, and then sets restrictions on an organization of public employees from how they spend political funds and how they have to report spending on political funds. It's interesting, Senator Sifton yesterday introduced an amendment to the Paycheck Protection Bill that is being considered by the Senate that would have subjected all 501c4 public interest charitable organizations to the same reporting requirements that Paycheck Protection would impose on unions, and the Republican-led Senate would have none of it.
This is special for unions, right? So, okay.
Yes, so, yes. The governor's new charity can spend its money however it wants, but okay. Social workers, not so much.
Yeah. That's the old SB 21. We'll get to how it was amended in a minute, but I want to jump to House Bill, is it 637? Yeah, 637, which is still alive, although not getting as much attention, introduced by Steve Helms. And this one really raises questions about the whole concept of collective bargaining, which is the idea that the union bargains for all of the workers in the bargaining unit on their wages and working conditions, and that individuals then give up their right to bargain. This would give them back their right to bargain individually. Is that right?
That is correct. So under that scenario, so I'm a children's service worker. And, you know, under the scenario that this legislation envisions, if I wanted to agree with the children's division that I would work for $10 an hour, if I, you know, got a chance to get a promotion faster, I would be allowed to do that. If I could get the state to agree, I could agree. And the idea of exclusive representation is a real bedrock of how collective bargaining has worked in the United States since there's been collective bargaining. The reason why the union and why the members of the union want to retain exclusive representation is that it significantly increases our power to negotiate a good contract that covers everybody and is in everybody's interests. It's to not have that is a recipe for setting the workers in a workplace against each other, and ultimately racing to the bottom to try to win favors from the boss.
Okay, enough said on that. It's interesting. It seems like the strategy of these Republicans is either to overregulate unions and kill them that way, of course, while they're complaining about overregulation of business all the time, or it's to undercut the whole basis on which unions are formed with bills like this or with right to work. The whole idea that it's a collective decision, and because workers don't have any power as individuals, they only have power collectively, and it's attacking that whole idea by appealing to so-called individual rights. But now we have SB 210 has been tacked on to SB 21 and made what was a relatively simple paycheck protection or paycheck deception bill into a super draconian anti-public worker bill. You want to tell us what is in that?
Yeah, so everything you said is right except the vehicle. So they have morphed SB 210 into the House Bill 251.
Ah, okay.
As passed by the House was plain vanilla paycheck and has now been morphed into a monster anti-collective bargaining, anti-union bill by an amendment in the Senate Committee on General Laws.
And you said this is similar to what they passed in Wisconsin under Scott Walker in 2011?
It is very similar to what was passed in Wisconsin under Scott Walker in 2011. The biggest differences are that public employees in Wisconsin actually had a well-defined set of rights to organize and bargain in Wisconsin law, I believe, since the 30s.
Yeah, they were the first state to give public employees the right to collective bargaining.
Right, right. Missouri has a statute that gives public employees the right to organize and the right to gain exclusive representation and the right to meet and confer. But the senator who is sponsoring this effort, Senator Bob Onder from St. Charles, has a point in that Missouri right now, our public employee labor law is a bit of a undefined entity. And it's sort of cobbled together from some statutes here and there and from some Supreme Court rulings and local government practices. So what Senator Onder is proposing to do with his amendment to House Bill 251, in his original bill with Senate Bill 210, is to radically redefine the rules that public employee organizations have to operate under. His radical redefinition would effectively mean the end of public employees having the right to organize in this state. Now, he can't do that because of our state constitution. So they can't just pass a law that says public employees do not have the right to organize, because the Missouri Bill of Rights gives every worker the right to organize. So instead of just outright reversing the will of the people, the bill that Senator Onder is pushing the Senate to consider imposes 24 categories of restrictions on public employee organizations. Taken together, those restrictions will effectively make it impossible for public employees to have an official relationship with their employers through any kind of an organization. You know, the consequences of that are huge. It wasn't that long ago that public jobs in Missouri were just doled out as political favors, where and we still have remnants of that with our license collection system here in Missouri, patronage job. That is very much something that could happen as public employee rights continue to be attacked by our very anti-public worker legislature.
So if they just pass a simple paycheck deception, what's the impact going to be on our public sector unions? Is it really terrible?
I can speak most. I'm sorry, Judy. Go on.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
So, I mean, I can speak most directly for my local. So we represent 6,000 employees who work for the Missouri Department of Social Services. Those 6,000 employees work in 238 different job sites that are located in every single county in the state of Missouri. They work 7 days a week, 24 hours per day. And if the plain vanilla paycheck protection legislation passes, the union will have to collect from all 6,000 of those employees every year a new authorization for the employees to continue to be members of the union. So even if we visited one new job site every day of the year, that's basically what we would have to do, would be spend almost all of our time collecting membership authorizations. So what does that mean we can't do? That means we can't spend time getting our members to the state capitol to talk to senators and representatives about the work that we actually do to protect Missouri's children and provide for Missouri's families. We can't do that. We can't spend time trying to work with our managers to improve conditions or solve problems in the facilities where we work. We can't spend time talking to each other about changes that we would like to make together to make our jobs better and make us better able to serve Missouri's people. Instead, we have to spend virtually all of our time talking to people about signing membership reauthorization cards.
Don't you have a steward system? And can't the stewards collect those authorization cards?
So we do have a steward system, our stewards, would definitely be a major part and are a major part of what we're doing to prepare for this.
Uh-huh.
our stewards are pretty limited in what they're allowed to do at work. So we've got stewards, I think the closest building to the KKFI studio is on 13th Street downtown in Kansas City.
Uh-huh, the state office building.
That building has about 185 CWA represented state employees in it.
Uh-huh.
We have three or four stewards in that building. They're allowed to go around and collect those authorization cards during their 2 15-minute breaks that they get every day. And they don't really get those 15-minute breaks every day. They also have to use those breaks to eat their lunch, to take care of their personal needs. It's you know, our state employees do not have a lot of idle time, contrary to what I think is big in our popular imagination.
Yeah, right. Okay, thanks. And real briefly, because we're just about out of time, if the enhanced House Bill, whatever it is, 251, were to pass with the under additions, what would that do to your union?
So we don't have a union because we have a permission slip from the state of Missouri. So we're not going to go away. But it will make it much, much harder for those of us who work at the Social Services Department to have an organization. That'll be true for every teacher, every bus driver, every firefighter in this state. And we will have another major obstacle put in the way to our having an organization that can improve our working conditions. It's going to be a huge challenge, and we're going to have to figure out new ways to rise up to it.
All right. Well, and I heard you say that it would put a Missouri into a situation much closer to Texas or North Carolina, where unionization is, frankly, you can't get a recognition for a union at all. But that's another topic. So what are you doing to fight back, and what do you want people to do?
Well, so our members are talking to their coworkers about why they need to be in the union and why they need to continue to support the union, even if the state legislature tries to put obstacles in the path of that. So that's a major effort, a major conversation we're having within our union. Our members are also coming to Jefferson City. Actually, we're having another group come up next week to talk to their legislators. And we're also doing a major call-in campaign. If you're interested in helping out with that, I'd say the best place to check is the Missouri AFL-CIO's website. They've got a link that can take people directly to their state senator or their state representative, depending on where the bill is at the time, to tell them that we'd rather have our elected officials focusing on Missouri's real needs and not attacking public employees.
Okay, and we'll put a link to that website on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. Thank you very much, Bradley. We've been talking to Bradley Harmon, president of Communications Workers Local 6355, representing Missouri public employees. Good luck.
Thanks, Judy.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about a recent Supreme Court decision that's very good for workers, and that is a decision related to an ordinance that was passed in St. Louis in 2015, actually, that raised the minimum wage from the Missouri minimum wage of $7.70 to $11 by 2018. Now, this, as I said, this ordinance was originally passed in 2015, but it didn't immediately take effect because there was a bunch of lawsuits related to it, and also the Missouri legislature passed a House bill, House Bill 722, that tried to preempt local ordinances. Now, the purpose of the House bill was saying that it would be very confusing if local cities could have their own minimum wage rather than having one statewide minimum wage, because that means that St. Louis could have a minimum wage and Kansas City could have a minimum wage, Sedalia could have a minimum wage, and that would be really confusing. St. Louis, of course, argued that the standard of living is different in a big city. Kansas City has a similar argument. In any case, there was a clause in House Bill 722 that said it would not preempt local ordinances passed by August 28, 2015, which happened to have been the day that the St. Louis minimum wage ordinance took effect. In any case, there was a number of lawsuits related to the St. Louis ordinance, and it has finally got to the Supreme Court, and just recently the Supreme Court issued a ruling stating that the St. Louis minimum wage ordinance should be allowed to take effect. So that's great news. St. Louis is, of course, the St. Louis people that wanted to pass this ordinance are very happy, because they argue that, of course, like I said, living in a big city the size of St. Louis, the cost, the standard of living is hugely different than living in different places, and that this minimum wage increase will greatly help their low-wage workers and their wage-and-hour workers. The minimum wage increase also gives this minimum wage increase over a period of time, so that allows businesses to adjust to it. It doesn't just automatically raise it from $7.70 an hour to $11 an hour. Does it over a period of time. I imagine that there may be additional litigation related to this particular issue. Now, preemption is something that we see a lot in the law. In the law, there are various stages of the law, and so that means there are different levels. Local ordinances are preempted, which means overridden by something that is conflicted in state legislation. State legislation is conflicted or preempted by something that is in a state constitution. A state constitution and state laws are preempted by federal law, which means that if there's something that is that it conflicts between federal law and a state constitution, a state law, or a local ordinances, federal law wins. Same thing with federal law is preempted by the federal constitution, of course, which preempts everything. So if anything, whether it's a local ordinance or a federal law conflicts with the federal constitution, then the federal constitution wins. That's kind of the hierarchy of the way laws work in the legal system. So the legislature is within its right to try to preempt something because a local ordinance, because they are a higher level of government than a local ordinance is. However, in this particular case, the Supreme Court found that there isn't a conflict between the local ordinance in this case and the state law, because they found that they're both trying to protect the same thing and they both have legitimate interests. So this is going to be very interesting. It might have some interesting consequences for wage and hour fights throughout the state. That's all the time we have tonight. Thank you for listening, Kansas City. Again, this is Angie Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams here in Kansas City. You can find me on the web at williamslawkc.com. Thanks for listening, and have a great night. Be safe.
Okay, and this is Heartland Labor Forum calendar for this week. Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast is this coming Saturday, March 18th at 8:15 for breakfast, 9:15 for speaker, and it is at the Dot Spot, which is at 8123 Parallel Parkway in Kansas City, Kansas, 66112. We had the monthly clinic for victims of wage theft. That is this coming Monday, March 21st from 5 to 8 at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. And then this coming Thursday, we have Missouri State Representative Greg Razor Town Hall. And that is from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Burns and McDonald, 9450 Ward Parkway. And lastly, we have got Richard Wolf on the Trump economy and what can be done about it. This is a KKFI fundraiser. That is next Friday, March 24th at 7 p.m. for the talk and 6 p.m. for the VIP dinner. That's going to be at the Carpenters District Council, 8955 East 38th Terrace, Kansas City, Missouri. And you can go to kkfi.org if you want to get tickets. Okay, next week on the Heartland Labor Forum. She doesn't have anything listed. I have no idea, so I guess it'll be a big surprise. I have been Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.